Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
It's the end of the year. It's the end of the year.
It would be a mistake to advertise to ISIL that there are safe havens for them outside of Iraq or Syria.
And the world is shaped by people like Jim Foley and the overwhelming majority of humanity who are appalled by those who killed him.
The ability to steal gossipy email is not the same as physical 9/11 style attacks.
Russia's political and economic isolation will only increase.
The United States will not torture.
On the last day of this year, we start the hour with a look back at some of the global events of 2014 that fundamentally reshaped geopolitics. There's the rise of ISIS in the Middle East, Russia's annexation of Crimea, violence over the summer in Gaza, and a peace process that seems to be moving further away with Israel. Nuclear talks with Iran, the Senate report on torture, the thawing of U.S. relations with Cuba, a new wave of cyber attacks to help us break down the year that is and the year that was. Shadi Hamid, he's a fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kimberly Martin is our friend and professor of political science at Barnard College at Columbia University.
Todd, thanks for having me back.
And Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you so much.
It's very good to have you all. And Shadi, let me start with you and let's start in the Middle East. You have said that the rise of ISIS in Syria and Iraq represents a basic failure of U.S. foreign policy, certainly dating back to the Iraq War in 2003. Explain.
Sure. Well, what was so bad about 2014 in this respect is there comes a point where you can't undo the damage. With the rise of ISIS, Iraq and Syria are never going to go back to what they were before. So in that sense, as we go forward, we're going to see divided societies. We're not going to see cohesive states. And the broader trend is really a collapse of the regional order in the Middle East as we know it, that the rise of ISIS doesn't just affect Iraq and Syria, but has spillover effects across the region. And I think the problem here is this was not just predictable, but it was predicted. Syria experts were warning this administration as early as 2012 that if we don't do more to intervene proactively in Syria, there's going to be a political vacuum and extremists and terrorists are going to rise to the fore and become the dominant actors. And that's precisely what happened, not just with ISIS, but also with the Al-Qaeda affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria. And there's some irony here because Obama was so insistent on not getting dragged in to Syria in 2012 that he saw his legacy as extracting the U.S. from these Middle East entanglements. But this is the cost of dithering. You wait, and then 2 or 3 years later, you're dragged back in, and the intervention is going to be more involved, more costly, and more bloody. And that's what we're seeing today.
Shadi Hamid, the trip of ISIS or ISIL from Syria across Iraq was so horrific and has been so horrific and so entangling that many people have, in a way, forgotten about the war between Gaza and Israel that took place earlier this year.
I almost forgot about it too. So, yes, the fact that when we kind of look back at 2014, Palestine-Israel doesn't even come up as one of the first things shows how messy this region is. We could also talk about the civil war in Libya, a consolidation of authoritarianism in Egypt. So it's a very long list of bad things. But I think what was so troubling about Israel-Palestine is that there could have been hope. There should have been hope. There were months-long negotiations that were taking place for a good chunk of 2014. Those didn't work out, and what we see is a return to violence. So we're very far away from addressing really the root causes of some of these conflicts, including in Gaza.
Well, Kimberly Martin, as we talk about root causes in the Middle East, one of the people we have to talk about is Vladimir Putin. And in a lot of ways, this was the year of Vladimir Putin. But what did we really see in Europe? Did the annexation of Crimea and the Russian-backed civil war in Ukraine change the balance of power at all in Eastern Europe?
Well, certainly Putin is attempting to change the balance of power. But I think what we have learned is that it's kind of amazing how well the United States and Europe have stuck together on the sanctions regime against Putin, which is actually harming Russia and putting Russia in a worse situation than it would have been otherwise. I think one of the things we have to remember is that the fact that the sanctions regime is sticking together so well is really due to something that could not have been predicted previously. And that was the downing of the Malaysian air flight number 17 that really brought Europeans together. The other thing that's happened that nobody had control over prior to it happening was the plummet in oil prices, which has made the sanctions regime have a great deal more impact in Russia than it might have had otherwise. And so Putin now faces the new year, the anniversary of his 15th year in power, with a very bad situation in the Russian economy.
Is there any way to determine what lessons Vladimir Putin may have taken away, not only from Europe sticking together on sanctions against him, but also from the resistance that he's confronted in eastern Ukraine?
I'm not sure that Putin is someone who takes lessons very well. He is unpredictable because he is acting primarily on behalf of his own interests, of himself and his personal network, and he's using the kinds of techniques of masking and deception that come from his KGB past. So I think it's unclear what Putin might be deciding to do in the future. But one thing we know for sure is that it's very unlikely that he would ever take any steps that make it appear as though he is bowing into the will of the West. He is not going to blink, because if it appears at any point that he is blinking, that means that the primary pillar on which he has based his entire time in office, his ability to stand up to the West and to show that Russia is a great power, would be completely shaken. And so I don't think we're likely to see more Russian cooperation coming from Putin.
Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh, there was a time when to speak of Russia and the former Soviet Union and somebody like Vladimir Putin, perhaps, was to talk about Cuba, because they were such an important satellite. Times have changed, and there's no doubt now that normalizing relations with Cuba is not only closing sort of a long chapter of animosity, but also potentially resetting relationships in the Western Hemisphere.
Absolutely. I think it'll be the historic opportunity in March when, first time in decades, that the U.S. and Cuba will be together for the Latin American summit. President Obama calls this a new chapter in our relations, but still the same book, because the Castros are still in power. So there's a limited amount of economic moves that the president can do, but certainly on the diplomatic front, it will be quite a day when you see the flags of each country flying over in both Havana and in Washington.
Nancy Soderbergh, we also have to talk about cybersecurity. I know that you think it's one of the most important stories of 2014. Whether the Sony cyber attack came from North Korea or from another source, this was not the first attack of its kind, but it did permeate the public's attention more than any other. Is this because movies and movie stars were involved, or is there something fundamentally different here in the Sony attack?
I think that this caught the imagination because it's real-life movie being played out in our lives, so it's going to get attention. But the number one threat that we have, and it's not just me, it's the director of the National Intelligence puts out an annual report, and cybersecurity has surpassed terrorism as our number one threat, and we're behind the curve. The North Korean dictatorship or some big disgruntled Sony employee, the fact that we can't even tell that for sure tells you how hard this is to stay ahead of the curve. And the fact that a person sitting somewhere could shut down an entire country's grid is a frightening scenario. And we are not ahead of the curve on this. It's our number one threat. It is moving so fast, so dangerously, and so quickly that we're just not ahead. So I think this will continue to grow as an enormous threat, regardless of how the Sony North Korea story unwinds in the end.
Well, to each of you, my three guests, it wouldn't be 2014 unless I got some predictions for 2015 out of each of you. Shadi Hamid, we talked about the Middle East. Where do you think the confrontation with ISIS heads this next year?
Well, I think the big problem is there isn't really a strategy, particularly not in Syria. We're trying to train about 5,000 fighters with $500 million, which is really a drop in the bucket in the larger sweep of what's happening in Syria. So there still is a resistance in really addressing the big elephant in the room is who do you actually support on the ground? Are there enough people to support? But also the fact that the Assad regime, in all of its brutality, is a big part of the problem. And there's no way to address Syria in the coming years without having something to say about that part of it. And there doesn't seem to be any willingness to really confront that. So in that sense, I mean, ISIS and the after effects of ISIS will be with us, not just for 2015, but for many years to come. So that's why, you know, in some ways we have to prepare ourselves for, you know, a very long struggle. And I'm not sure if the American people or the American leadership really have it in them to really stay the course, if you will, on ISIS and a number of other issues that, you know, as bad as they look in 2014, they might actually get worse in ways that we might not be able to anticipate right now. And I think that's one of the main lessons of the Arab Spring is if it can get worse, it probably will.
Professor Kimberly Martin, let me get a prediction from you about Russia. A more constructive Vladimir Putin cowed by sanctions and the collapse of the ruble?
I doubt it. I think he has a very strong incentive to never do anything that would indicate that he's giving in to Western pressure. But I think what happens in Russia this spring is going to be something interesting to watch. I think the timing of what happened yesterday with Navalny was not accidental. People are going into a two-week New Year holiday, which is the most important cultural holiday in Russia, where everything shuts down. People get together and party and drink with their friends and talk to each other. And what they're going to be talking about this time around is certainly the terrible state of the Russian economy. And it's just going to be interesting to see as the economy continues to be in trouble in Russia, all of the evidence indicates that oil prices are going to stay low, what that means for the Russian budget, for social services, for protests by ordinary people who start feeling the pinch of things. So I think we're entering a dangerous time in Russia. I don't predict that we're going to have a lot of good relations between Russia and the West in the near future. And I think we just have to wait and see.
I want to thank each of you for joining us to help us understand 2014 and also give us a roadmap for the coming year, no matter how troubling it may be. Nancy Soderberg, former ambassador to the United Nations, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Professor Kimberly Martin of Barnard College at Columbia University and our resident Russia expert. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Todd.
And of course, Shadi Hamid, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of the new book, Temptations of Power, Islamists and a Liberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Thanks, Shadi.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, it's never too early to get involved in politics, you know, but in a lot of places, it can be too early to get elected, that's for sure. My next guest is young, but he's already had a hand in shaping state legislation in his home state of Georgia. He's executive director of Young Georgians in Government. And C.J. Pearson is pushing Georgia lawmakers to lower the minimum age to run for a seat in Georgia's House of Representatives. Hi, C.J.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How old? Tell me.
I'm 12 years old.
You're 12. Okay. CJ, first of all, you have to be 21 right now to run for the state house in Georgia, right?
Yes, you do.
And 25 to run for the state senate. Why do you want to lower those ages?
Well, personally, I strongly believe that, you know, if you're old enough to die for your country, pay taxes, and vote, then you should be given the opportunity to represent your community in the Georgia legislature. I believe that there are many capable young people across the entire state of Georgia that are ready to take that active step in leading in their government. And it's time that the lawmakers across the entire state give them the opportunity, because it's our future that they're dealing with right now. So why not give us the opportunity to preserve our own future and fight for the solutions that we believe that would solve the many issues facing our state and our country.
So you want to lower the age of running in Georgia to 18 for both the House and the Senate?
We want to lower it for the state House to the age of 18 and for state Senate to the age of 21.
Now, in West Virginia, Sarah Blair got elected to the state legislature at age 18. She must have been an inspiration to you.
You know, definitely, you know, she was actually trending on Twitter. That's how I heard of her. And, mm-hmm. you know, I saw that, you know, she's 18. she became the youngest state lawmaker in the entire country. I was really inspired. You know, I'm 12 years old. You know, I definitely do have political aspirations. And so with that being said, I looked at our state constitution and I just thought, okay, if history can be made over in West Virginia, then it can definitely be made here in Georgia. Why can't you represent your constituents? And why can't you represent the people of Georgia? And I think that's a question that, you know, that many lawmakers are going to be faced at. Answer. This upcoming session.
A lot of people are going to be answering that question because you have pushed many of them to get your initiative into the legislature. But, you know, CJ, you hit on a question that a political reporter like me was coming around to, and I'm glad you brought it up. You said you have political aspirations of your own. And whenever anyone starts tinkering with a state constitution or with election rules, we political reporters wonder if they're not doing this to benefit themselves. Now, you have political aspirations, and it sounds to me like you want to try to get in there as fast as possible yourself.
Well, you know, I'm 12 years old, okay? If this does pass the legislature, it's going to be a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 2016. That's going to be in 2 years. I'm going to be 14. If that does pass in 2016 on the ballot, I still have to wait 4 more years. It's really no rush for me. You know, the Georgia Teen Republicans and, you know, the high school Democrats are heavily involved in politics, and they have the capabilities to leave. We just need to give them the opportunities.
Oh, well said. Well said. You're turning already. Constitutional amendment, CJ, in the state of Georgia, what do you need to be successful?
You need 2/3 of support from each chamber of the legislature, and you need to pass with 50% of the people have to agree with the referendum on the ballot. And if they vote for it and it has more than 50% report, it becomes part of the law.
Before I let you go, CJ, you know, let's get practical. If I were a Republican, I might look at your bill and say, you know, I'm for it, but young people, young voters tend to skew Democratic. If I sponsor this, a lot of young people might want to come out and vote for a younger candidate. That doesn't necessarily help Republicans, at least on average. So I don't know. It's not necessarily in our interest. That's just real.
Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, let's get practical. We like being empowered. And if a Republican state senator or state representative give us the opportunity to be empowered by our government and give us the right to run, then we're going to take it and we're going to remember that. But it really doesn't matter what the party affiliation is. It's more about empowering young people to take a more active role in their government.
CJ Pearson is on his way to Atlanta with a constitutional amendment in Georgia to lower the age of membership in the House to 18 and the Senate to 21. CJ's executive director of Young Georgians in Government. CJ, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, some of us will be with family or friends tonight on this New Year's Eve. Some of us will be on our own. Still, for others, New Year's can be a very lonely time. And that got reporter Anna Sale thinking about the way we live today. More than a quarter of American households are home to just one person. That's 33.2 million people who are living alone. And that number has tripled since 1970.
Cooking the things I want to eat, playing the music that only I enjoy listening to.
Dancing around my living room to R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Countless minutes of no interruptions.
I usually have the windows open because I like the fresh air.
Nobody to tell me not to sleep in the middle of my queen-size bed.
Books stacked in a certain way on my shelf.
It is definitely a freedom that I've not had ever.
Those are voices from the latest episode of WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money, the podcast hosted by Anna Sale. And Anna's with me. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Todd.
I am one of the people who lives alone by choice. Eventually, I hope I'll live with somebody else. But right now, it's me and my cat, and we do just fine. And I really like it. I'm there. I'm doing it because I want to.
Well, Todd, you are on trend. That's what the Census Bureau says in the U.S., because that's what's happening in part is young men and women are delaying first marriage. And that's why we're seeing this increasing number of single person households. One person I talked to who represented this is a woman named Ashley Ward. She lives in Los Angeles. And she talked about what it was like to move from having roommates to having a place all her own.
You know, whenever you're little and you're wearing your mom's shoes, mm-hmm. like it felt like that. Like you don't fill out the shoe or the apartment at all, but like here you are pretending like you do.
And then Anna, you know, the other side of that, once you grow into the shoe, is that you've worn the shoe for so long that it fits just perfectly and you don't want anyone tying it for you, you know?
That's something else I heard is for people who live alone after not living alone for a long time, what that transition is like. I heard from a guy named Waleed Shantour who lives in Ithaca, New York, and he was married for a long time. And he's actually representative of the trends because women have historically lived alone at higher rates than men. But that gap is shrinking. Here's his story.
After my wife came out to me, I was quite devastated because my daughter left for college the same day that my wife moved out of the house. So all of a sudden, after all those years, I was alone. I would have to say that I was in a funk for a good part of 6 months to a year. And I started realizing how satisfying it was living alone.
You must have confronted a lot of that, people in transition from the idea of loneliness, which is different from being alone, to the idea of the utter independence and do what you want-ism of living all by yourself, everything from making eggs naked to just having control over your own time and your own space.
And often both of those feelings happened in the same households. I talked to a woman named Arlene Pickett, and she's 70 years old. She lives in Denver, and her husband died 4 years ago. So she lived alone for the first time in her 60s. And she talked about, at first, it was like, wow, I can make every decision totally on my own. I am in charge in a way I've never been in charge in my life. And that felt great. And then she got sick. She was diagnosed with cancer in January and then had to go through chemo and then felt alone in a way that didn't feel comfortable. Here's how she described that.
Part of me kind of wonders, you know, is this what it's going to be like? Am I going to be one of these elderly people you read about that's all by himself or all by herself and nobody checks in, nobody calls, and then something happens? That kind of weighs on my mind.
There's a tension here, Anna, it strikes me, not only between what I mentioned, like the independence of making eggs all naked if you want to do that, but also the notion of having to be taken care of. It's a little bit antiquated. It can be sexist in a way. On the other hand, we're all people. We're social creatures. And yeah, sometimes we do need to be taken care of. There's a real tension there.
There's a real tension, and in that there are stories about what are the social networks that you create for yourself when you do live alone. Who are the people that you call when you feel a little nervous about the sound you're hearing outside of the window? Who are the people you go on walks with every day to feel connected? I heard all kinds of those stories. One woman I talked to who was right in this interesting transition place is a woman named Lisa Wagner. She's in her early 40s. She's never lived alone, but she is on the verge of it. Her youngest daughter is about to leave for school, and she cannot wait to live alone for the first time. Lisa just got divorced 3 years ago, and she described what she did when she had her bedroom all to herself.
I felt like I worked really hard and earned a lot of money and came home to a house that wasn't really pleasant, and I was frustrated with that. The night after we had that final fight and we decided to separate, I couldn't sleep, and I lay in bed, and I started imagining how I was going to fix up the bedroom once it was just mine, and it got me through.
Well, Lisa was going to take control of the space, literally.
And she did. She describes polishing the floors, doing new caulking, putting a shelf in her closet just for scarves because she has a lot of scarves. So these stories really reveal, like, what happens when all of a sudden you get to create the space that's all your own, and then the trade-offs of that.
You know, before we go, Anna Sale, when I was reading all about your segment on death, sex, and money, it, for me, just reminded me of Liz Lemon on 30 Rock. Tina Fey did this perfectly. Liz Lemon was terrified of dying alone at home, choking on a fish stick, and no one would ever know until a week later when they smelled the smell coming from her apartment because she lives alone. She, I think, eventually did choke on a fish stick and had to give herself the Heimlich maneuver on the kitchen counter.
Well, I don't want to end on that note. Todd, I also want to say the other thing that hearing these stories of people who've lived alone at all different stages of their lives, that it's a time when you're all by yourself, you find the ways that you comfort yourself. So it's not just all doing the Heimlich on kitchen counters.
A time to know yourself better.
A time to know yourself better in a really important way.
Oh, we could all be so lucky. I'm glad that I'm not alone in the studio, Anna Sale. I'm glad that you're here to walk us through this. Anna Sale is host of WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money. You can hear the latest episode on people who live alone. Find it at deathsexmoney.org. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you, Todd.
We're asking you this hour, be honest, what didn't get done in 2014? From Charlotte in North Carolina, I didn't successfully launch my new business. It will take some time to determine what went wrong, correct, and relaunch, but probably not by tomorrow.
This is Jeannie calling from Orlando, Florida. My 2014 goal was to earn an award or promotion in the military, And since I did not achieve that goal, I've decided to abandon it in 2015 and apply for Marine Corps Officer School.
Coming up, we review the 10 best things on the internet in 2014. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Breakdown, baby. Every Friday here on The Takeaway, we love to have Sean Ramesfaran on with his Friday Five, his sort of top five internet things to know over the week. Well, it's Wednesday. It's not Friday, but it's New Year's Eve, which means there's a whole year behind us. Sean is here. It's not five, it's 10. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Yeah, I recommend everyone spend their New Year's Eve on the internet, just hanging out.
I should say Sean Ramesfaran is from Sideshow, which is the entertaining podcast from our friends upstairs at Studio 360 at WNYC. Sean, kick us off.
One.
Clickhole.com.
Yeah. Have you ever taken a digital detox and internet vacation?
For about 72 hours.
Yeah. The faster route to that and the cheaper way is to just go to clickhole.com, which is this satirical site created by The Onion that basically makes fun of the most inane corners of the internet. So it's like mostly comprised of listicles and quizzes and fake celebrity gossip.
And clickbait.
All the clickbait, exactly. So it's essentially a satire of virality, of anything that ever aspired to go viral. But my favorite thing they did this year was an article called The Time I Spent on a Commercial Whaling Ship Totally Changed My Perspective on the World. It was written by a sailor named Ishmael, and below a photo of a whale's fin was the entire text of Moby Dick. It was perfect. It's like one of the smartest things I've ever seen online.
If you hate brands and everything that the internet has done with brands, Clickhole is the place for you. That's my favorite thing about it. Now, the very opposite of short-form listicle satire is long-form satire, which is John Oliver.
John Oliver, sure. He's got Last Week Tonight Now on HBO, presumably, but really most people are watching his show on YouTube, where his like long satirical and cogent monologues are uploaded every week. He helped crash the FCC's website this year by asking commenters to voice their opinions on a net neutrality forum.
We need you to get out there and for once in your lives, focus your indiscriminate rage in a useful direction. Seize your moment, my lovely trolls. Turn on caps lock and fly, my pretties.
And people did. They flew right to the FCC
website.
It worked. Now, much calmer, maybe much more serious, but no less in the world of fandom was the podcast Serial.
Three.
Yeah, my favorite thing about Serial is how good it's been for other podcasts as the host of a podcast. Maybe that's shallow sounding, but like it became a phenomenon, a cultural phenomenon. Fred Armisen tried to do an SNL sketch about Ira Glass a couple years ago, and Lorne Michaels or whoever makes those decisions said, no one's going to get this. The last episode of SNL this season had a 5-minute long Serial satire, and Funny or Die did one too, and they're all hilarious.
On this week's Serial.
Oh, sorry, Sarah. Sorry. The executives from MailChimp are here. They just wanted to say hi. We are very excited about this. I gotta be honest, this child murder has been really great for MailCrimp.
Do you mean MailChimp?
Yeah, that's what I said. I use MailChimp.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Goofing on sort of the advertising, the sponsorship that goes along with Serial there. You know, that Twitter loved the joke that maybe the MailChimp did it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's hard to laugh at this thing about murder, but so many people found so many different ways to do it. Like, there's a day where I went on iTunes and the top 10 podcasts included Serial at number one, and then two additional podcasts that are just about Serial. Huge phenomenon, and it's kind of amazing.
Now, I need your help with this one. What is Run the Jewel?
Run the Jewels is a hip-hop duo. It's kind of like a hip-hop supergroup comprised of this guy, LP from Brooklyn, and Killer Mike from Atlanta. And these two guys are both like 39 years old and are late in their career, but they released easily the most important rap album of the year. You want to hear a little bit?
Let's do it.
It be feeling like the life that I'm living, man, on control. Every day I'm in a fight for my soul. Could it be that my medicine's the evidence for pigs to stop and frisk me when they rolling around on patrol? And ask why you're here. I just tell them because it is what it is. ideas. I live here, and that's what it is. Each time you got a dime, I said, man, I'm trying to smoke and chill. Please don't lock me up in front of my kids.
I've heard this without knowing what it was. Now I know what Run the Jewels is because I know this song.
Yeah, so in addition to having like really versatile raps and really great beats that are sort of innovative, the album addressed a lot of the racial unrest that was unfolding in this country in the latter part of the year, and that's when it came out. And it started leaking online and then quickly blew up and just became the biggest and most important rap album of the year. It's great.
Fine.
Sean, in a lot of ways, this was the year that Vine really came into its own. 6-second videos, everybody kind of thought it would come and go away, or that only 12-year-olds would be into it. It's really not the case.
Totally, yeah. Vine's launching memes. It's launching cover stories in like New York Magazine this year, think pieces, careers, and generally just my favorite from the year was, what you can see on the Takeaway site, was this kid named Christian Leonard, who does a lot of trick photography with his telephone, and it's just this really great Vine of a kid jumping in a pool, and there's something very surprising that happens all in 6 seconds. And this guy, Christian Leonard, he's now making Vines for like Chrysler and Chips Ahoy, all his sponsored content in his feed. He's like 20 years old and probably makes more money than both of us.
Six?
Now, your number six is my number one personally because I absolutely love High Maintenance.
Great, yeah.
I love it. I pay for it. I'd pay double for it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's like easily the best web series online and potentially one of the better TV shows out there. It's about this marijuana delivery guy in New York City who bikes around delivering weed, but it's really about these people he delivers his weed to and their lives and their loneliness and their love.
Your business must be doing very well.
Yeah, it's like today's the Thanksgiving of smoking pot or something.
And this is the kind that makes you want to eat, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it does that.
Is it very strong? I don't smoke. How much do you have to do to make something happen?
Oh, Ellen, you're going to have such a good time. I remember, gosh, this was years ago, Jerry and I got free tickets to a Steely Dan concert. Jerry got high, of course I didn't, but I must have gotten a contact high because when we got home, I ate 2 boxes of French bread pizza.
But the beauty of High Maintenance for me, actually, it's not about pot at all. It's about a guy who meets lots of different people.
Yep.
Incidental to being a pot dealer, but it draws character sketches so distinctly and with such great borders. It's just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's on point.
7!
Now, moving on, Sean, I'm glad you're here because every single time I see on Twitter, and I see it all the time, a funny picture of Kermit the Frog sipping Lipton tea, not to buzz market, but that's what the meme is. Yeah. I don't get the joke. Everybody else gets it. But me, it's the one joke I feel on Twitter that I am not in on.
This is a meme that its brilliance lies in the fact that anyone can project anything of it. It's an image of Kermit the Frog in front of a window some morning sipping Lipton tea. And it always says, but that's none of my business. That's the meme on the bottom. It's, but that's none of my business. But on the top, it's whatever you want. So it could be, you know, you're not supposed to wear a red sweater on Tuesdays, but that's none of my business. Or it could be, you know, we should be working right now, but instead we're watching a soap opera. But that's none of my business. I think its versatility lies in the fact that it can be anything.
It's whatevs, you be you.
Yeah, it just blew up.
Number 8.
Too Many Cooks is something we've talked about before. It's stupendous and crazy.
It's an 11-minute satire of TV sitcoms from the 80s onward, and it's just unbelievably on point.
It takes a lot to make a stew.
A pinch of salt and laughter too.
A scoop of kids to add the spice.
A dash of love to make it nice, and you've got...
All right, let's keep that short. We've heard enough because if you hear too much of that, it'll bring back PTSD-like symptoms from watching Too Many Cooks. Let's move on to the ice cream van.
Number 9?
Yeah, sure. So it's called the ice cream van, and it's two kids eating baked beans on toast somewhere in the UK, and things happen. People start falling down, and it's just – it makes me so happy.
Really, really worth going to. Now, the last
12 million people have watched it, so, I'm not alone.
See a Chandelier is the last one on your list.
It is. I mean, we should go out with some music, and See a Chandelier was perhaps the best music video of the year. In my book, it was –
Sean Ramos from Sideshow. Can the internet only get better in 2015?
Let's hope so. Things need to get better. So if the internet does it, that'll be great.
Well, we'll have you back at the end of next year. And in the meanwhile, I'm sure, and it'll be even better than your list for 2014.
Thank you.
Sean Ramos from Sideshow. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks.
You can check out Sean's top 10 moments from the internet on our website at thetakeaway.org. Meanwhile, I want to wish you a very happy and safe new year. Thank you so much for listening. And we're signing off for the last time in this 2014. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.